This is The Women of Letters, a podcast dedicated to the TV show Supernatural and everything fandom. Hi, and welcome to another Women of Letters podcast. This is Amy, and I'm here with Jules.
Hello, I'm Jules, still.
Thank goodness. I'd be worried if you weren't. So what are we going to talk today, Jules? We've got quite a lot to cover.
This time last week, you and I were all a squee. I was trying to be the good host and take Amy on a little tour around Melbourne last Sunday, and we'd stopped for a little high tea. We were having scones and tea, and certain photos started showing up from the 200th episode celebration party in Vancouver. So everything got put aside, and we spent our time and actually rushed
hovering over my phone.
Rushed home. We were looking at them on the phone, and then we rushed back to my place so we could see all the photos and tweets on the big screen. So it was a very exciting afternoon.
It was. There was there much squee to be had.
Yes, because as it started off, there was all the there was the pre-party tweets from all the cast and crew getting ready, and then there was a red carpet where the they had the Impala parked out the front, and you could have the they had like a photographer who was taking guests' photo with the Impala, and then there was a red carpet with the press, and there were interviews, and then we had a few photos from actually inside the party as well, and of course with the absolutely magnificent Impala cake.
Oh my God, that had working headlights.
I know. It was at the Pacific Rim Fairmont in Vancouver, which is right down on the water and is probably the swankiest hotel in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And it was a Hollywood event.
It was. Big red carpet, all the bloggers and everything were there doing their interviews, and we've seen some of those coming out over the last week, little bits and pieces dribbling out. From that, as they've talked to Jensen and Jared and Misha and Mark and everyone, some video interviews and also just some blog interviews. So it was a full-on swishy event with speeches from, looked like from both Peter Roth and
Mark Perowitz,
thank you.
CW.
The prez of the CW. And what is Peter Roth? Is he the prez of Warner Brothers Television or something?
I think he's the president of Warner Brothers.
Of Warner Brothers, full stop. Woof, that's pretty big time. So they were up there having their photos taken with everybody as well, all smiles and beaming, looking as proud as punch. So there were speeches, and then I saw that the boys did a speech as well at some point.
Yes, apparently they also did hilarious impersonations of some of the crew.
Oh, did they? Awesome.
And there was lots of amazing food and lots of drinking and dancing.
And that sounds great. It looked like they were all having a lovely time. All the photos that were being tweeted throughout the night, and then the next day when people were tweeting the photos that they'd had. So many of the crew got photos with the boys, which I thought was really adorable. And there were just so many, all, you know, like people from who do the sound down in LA, and, you know, they're all up there and they're getting their photos taken with the boys, and their wives were getting their photos taken with the boys, and they were tweeting them out. And I have to say that the boys were absolutely beaming. Their smiles were, you know, big. They looked like they were having an awesome time.
Yeah. Everyone looked gorgeous. Everyone was glammed up. It was a black tie event. So everyone was frocked up and suited up. And, it was a wonderful celebration. If you remember back, we had the, they had a party for the 100th, but it was not so Hollywood. I particularly remember the cake, which was looked like something that someone had picked up at Woolies on the way to the party. It was like one of those,
which is a supermarket for those who don't know.
Slab cake with white icing and happy
red roses or something,
and some red flowers on it, like totally generic. Not a front of the Impala with working headlights cake.
No, which was amazing. Yeah, I think this party was a little bit little bit flasher, because like at the 100th they actually had the Impalas play the crew band when Jensen played with them. It was a little bit more low key, I think. But this one was,
well, Warner Brothers were paying for it.
Well, there you go. This one was full of flash with the two big wigs up there. Because did you see the shot of all their chairs on set? On the Friday, they'd all gone to set to visit, and they had like a whole row. I can't remember who tweeted that photo. Now, was it Jason? Might have been Jason. It had a whole lot of their of the director's chairs for all the Warner Brothers execs, and I was like, "Geez, that would be nerve wracking. Be like putting on a play."
And it was Kripke was there, of course.
Of course,
Ben Edlund was there. You know, so there was actors past and present
and there was like Mark Pellegrino went, and Felicia was there. Well, she's shooting at the moment, so she was actually in town anyway, and Mark lives up there, doesn't he? So it was awesome. It was awesome to see all the pics and everybody just having a great time and really looking like they were celebrating and having a blast, and that was super cool.
It was.
Yeah. Yeah, and it kept me very busy for a few days.
I know. Yes, as little bits and pieces of photos and tales were tweeted. It was very, very happy time.
Mm-hmm. It was.
And, of course, Amy was down in Melbourne because we had the Armageddon Convention on down here, and we were blessed with the presence of we had Alana Huffman and we had Travis and AJ, the Ghost Faces, which was our main draw card along with Jenna Coleman from Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
So we trotted off on Saturday to see them.
Yeah, and I actually went to the function on the Friday night as well. But we'll hear about that in a little bit.
More about another guest later.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, on the Saturday we went along and we went to the we had kind of a bit of a blessed panel experience. Jules and I were kidding because you know we've done quite a few conventions and at the end of it we were like, oh, we don't feel like we've been to a con because we didn't queue once. It was kind of a very nice, easy con experience.
And apparently it was even quieter on Sunday,
which is that's pretty wild.
Our theory was a couple of things. One, it coincided in Melbourne with one of those weird churches, the Seventh Day Mormons or whatever they are, and there were like 50,000 of them in town.
Yeah.
And there was something else on as well. So I believe accommodation was very hard to find. Plus, it had only been a little while since Oz Comic Con that had, you know, some really, really big names at it.
Yeah.
So I think that those things combined, Jenna Coleman was probably the highest profile guest at Armageddon.
It actually did have, like, I think it seemed to have a smaller guest list, but maybe it was just there was a lot of Stargate people, and it seemed to have a not as broad guest list as it had, say, the year before, when I think there was a lot broader range of actors from different shows and stuff. But you know, we went, as you said, we went primarily for AJ and Travis and Alana, but also for Jenna, and we got to watch all their panels, which happened to be back to back.
Oh, I know, scheduling heaven.
It was awesome. We just planted. I know, and we could just sit and not move. Well, the only thing we did was move closer.
And because it wasn't packed out, those of us who didn't have gold tickets got to sit the gold ticket seats.
I know, it was So it was really, really good. And then they did great panels. I mean, I saw Alana at VanCon, as did you, and I saw the Ghost Faces for the first time at Vegas this year, and they were absolutely amazing. So, and they were so fun, and they all did great panels. I got up and asked Alana a few questions. I was quite surprised. I've never done that before.
You did very well, Amy.
I was nervous, but the microphone was right next to me, so I was like, I could just slip out, slip back in. No one hardly noticed. But yeah, they were great fun panels. Oh,
she was, she's an awesome woman, Alana. She is disappointed, I think, to have been be in the show anymore. She adored the character, loved working on the show. Obviously, enjoying coming to the conventions. I had some funny tales about having discovered Abaddon Dean fanfic. thanks to a friend who linked her. I said, hey, there's great fan art on Tumblr and all this, these stories. They write porn about you. So she was, yes, had discovered a particular story involving Dean in pink satin panties and Abaddon with a strap on. So,
yeah, so which we then later had to give her the pink satin panties reference because she didn't understand why Dean was in.
She knew it was canon, but she
didn't know why.
When Dean had worn pink satin panties.
So we had to explain that to her. She's like, oh, okay. We're like, yeah, of course, pink satin panties. Of course he was in those, whatever.
And as Amy and I, as we mentioned, we went to the dinner, celebrity dinner with them. Fortunately, AJ was unwell.
He's had a bit of a rough trot because he's broken his hand
because he got attacked by a clown with a chainsaw in Auckland. And
in a haunted house.
In a haunted house, as you do.
As you do, and he was running away.
Well, lucky he didn't get killed because, you know, that's what normally happens.
With clowns with chainsaws. But, yeah, so now he's got a fractured hand and torn ligaments in his leg or something. But, yeah, he was really feeling the jet lag or something. He was not feeling very well. But he was great. He hung in there for quite a long time, longer than I thought he would, and did quite well. But Travis and Alana stayed till the end. Alana actually stayed
past the end. You and I always seem to end up with the awesome guests who stay after everyone else is gone. And let us, like, big shout out, because AJ and Travis kept talking about their jet lag. Alana had her 4-year-old daughter, Charlie, with her. So she travelled across the Pacific with a 4-year-old and on her own. So she was at the con all day, Charlie was, with Alana.
And she was at the cocktail party on Friday night as well with Charlie.
And she was at the dinner. Alana put her down in a couple of chairs together in the foyer outside where the dinner was, and she slept through most of the dinner and only woke up when we were finishing dessert.
Yes, and then she came in and sort of was like a boneless child for a while, and she sort of flopped around.
She was like one of those cats that just sort of goes all limp on your lap.
And then she perked up right when Alana was probably wanting to go to bed.
I think that was Alana's fault for giving her sugar.
I think so too.
But she was very adorable. And Alana turns out to be quite the earth mother mm-hmm. who wants to live in a compound with all her children and grandchildren.
To build houses for them all. And
go a bit feral. So.
Have them all have at least 4 children and all live with her.
I think she's got four now.
Yeah, she's got four.
Her official plan had been 6.
Yes.
She wants to revise that.
And then she wants all of them to have a whole bunch as well so that there's like...
She wants flocks of grandchildren.
Flocks of grandchildren.
No, she was wonderful. And we had great... the thing that is wonderful about these dinners is that you get to have the sort of conversations... Not only you get to have conversations that you don't, you know, normally have time in a meet and greet's quite... limited to a series of questions mm-hmm. and you get to have conversations about things, you know, you wouldn't expect. So there were some things you'd expect. We talked a lot about, you know, TV and the rise of things like Netflix and Amazon Prime and, you know, Alana talked about the difficulties of being, you know, a woman over 30 and trying to get a role in television.
Even when you look like Alana.
Exactly. AJ talked about, you know, working on CSI, which was fascinating. Yeah. But we talked politics. We talked koala chlamydia.
The history of Culver City.
Yeah, Travis.
The LA transport system.
Yes. My favourite, Travis and I sort of, on top of being in a room full of nerds, we out-nerded everyone by being train spotters, basically.
And comparing transit cards.
Yeah, we both had our LA tap cards with us, which was seriously bizarre.
And he had a collector's version or something like that.
Oh, yes, he had the...
Some anniversary card.
The 100th anniversary of...
He pulled it out.
Oh, anyway, that was pretty hilarious.
That was pretty hilarious.
The... great thing that Travis and AJ, and again, and Amy and I have talked about this many, many times, the wonderful thing of conventions, how the guests themselves have become friends with each other. And obviously AJ and Travis filmed together as the Ghost Faces. They did the web series together and conventions and have become really, really good friends. And they've started, they're just about to start a project called Face It Forward, which is vaguely similar, and they did say they'd actually talk to Misha about the Random Acts charity that he does. So they basically are about, you know, passing on good things. They are going to support, and they haven't, can't release the names yet because they haven't finished all the paperwork. They were quite taken aback that, you know, you actually have to go through
bureaucracy to give people money.
But there will be an anti-bullying organisation and a women's refuge that they'll be raising money for. And we were lucky enough to get, I got a couple of, Amy donated hers to me, that's why I'm lucky, T-shirts from them, Face It Forward T-shirts with the ghost faces on the front that I'll give away on the Super Wiki Twitter, I think, once they start officially advertising it. So that's wonderful. I mean, it's, again, something that it has, you know, they've taken up as a project together, and they're very wonderful people, and it was just a joy to spend an evening with them.
Yeah, it was really lovely. It was they're all just lovely people, and I've had some very lucky experiences as being a fan and having the opportunity to do some of these dinners and meet and greets and whatever, you know, in the various conventions that I've done, whether, you know, the big Supernatural ones or multi-fandom conventions which have Supernatural fans. And just, they're all lovely. Like, every single cast member that you meet is lovely, is a lovely person, warm, friendly, down-to-earth, lovely people. And it's just, you know, you hear so much about, you know, actors with egos and things like that, and for some reason our show, and I think probably comes from the top, our show just doesn't seem to have any of those problems, or not that we see anyway.
Very smart people. The conversations we had last week, they were
really
good.
Think
about it, you're basically putting a whole bunch of strangers together, because I mean, we vaguely, or you knew a couple of the other fans at the dinner, and obviously Amy and I knew each other. But basically, you know, you've got 10 people who don't know each other having dinner, which can be a scary thing. And, you know, you can't sit and talk about Supernatural all night.
In fact, you usually don't.
In fact,
I don't even know that we did. We did briefly, I think, but it was maybe about some shooting experience, I think.
I think we barely
touch. And that's actually been my experience with all of those dinners that I've ever done, that we've never really talked about Supernatural. We talk about everything but, pretty much, you know. I think the only time I ever did that was I did one with Mark Pellegrino, and we had a discussion of how I saw Lucifer and how he saw Lucifer, which was a fabulous discussion to have with him. I think that's one of the good things. You actually just sit around and have conversations like you would at a normal dinner party.
Yeah. So they're very special, and I've said before, I'm not good in the photo. I don't do photo ops. I'm not good with the autograph. I walk up, don't make eye contact, push a piece of paper at the person. However, give me a couple of glasses of wine and 3 hours, and I can sort of relax into it and talk about LA public transport, because I'm that fascinating.
Or koala chlamydia.
Koala, oh God, I was thinking, yeah, that was probably the point, Jules. You should have realised you had enough to drink. When you hear the words koala chlamydia coming out,
It's a problem.
It is a big problem.
Very big problem.
I think it had come up because Alana was talking about taking Charlie to the zoo and meeting the kangaroos and koalas. And if you meet, most Australians will tell you koalas are as boring as shit, and we can't understand why people from overseas get so excited.
All they do is sleep and lie around in trees.
Yeah, if you live here, they're just a grey blob that sits up the tree, and very occasionally you see them walk on the ground. But if you pick them up, they scratch you and piss on you.
Yeah, exactly. They're angry little things.
Then you've got to worry about the fact they've got chlamydia. Yeah. That's how that came up.
Bye-bye.
But it was a lovely dinner. Aside from Dear Ridges, sort out your catering department.
Oh my gosh, poor Alana.
So there's trouble with the meals and the meal delivery. But aside from that,
that was fairly disastrous. And I think we were like almost like the kids' table or something. We were the forgotten table in the corner.
And the wonderful faux pas at the beginning when one of the staff from the convention came up to tell us that the guests, our celebrity guests would be with us shortly, and Alana was already at the table.
And we're like,
yeah, she's here.
Oh, my God. Awkward. awkward.
Well, you should remind yourself what your celebrity guests look like. Anyway, yeah, that was a bit awkward. That was rather funny and choices.
But yeah, and on the Friday night, should we go on to that? On the Friday night, tell us the surprise celebrity.
The surprise celebrity.
So some of you may already have heard me talking or read me talking. Whatever. On the Friday night, I went to the, because I did have God, so I went to the VIP cocktail party thing, which is not like the Creation cocktail parties. It's actually just in a bar, and the guests, or it's very Australian. It's just in a bar, and the guests come, and
it's
they
in a
just,
hotel bar.
It's in a hotel bar. Yeah, it's in a hotel. Well, it's in like a hotel nightclub, actually.
Okay.
It's like an empty nightclub. It's a very strange nightclub, but. That is Bobby McGee's is what it's called, by the way.
You're joking.
No, they do it at Bobby
McGee's.
No,
I didn't realise it was there.
They do. It's hilarious, right? So they, and basically what happens is, you know, it kicks off at 7 and from sort of about 7:30, the guests start arriving and they just mingle. And they just mingle and you can go up and talk to them and lots of people talk to them at once or, you know, they wander around and, you know, when it gets, if it gets a bit busy, they'll go from, table to table, but mostly you just go up and chat if you see them. And I was on my own, so even though I knew a couple of people there, I felt like a bit of a shag on a rock. And I did see Alana, but I didn't get a chance to talk to her, and she had Charlie with her. I saw AJ and Travis, and I kind of beelined immediately over to them to say hello. And surprising to me that AJ actually remembered me from Vegas Con, because we'd done Chad's ghost tour and the ghost faces had come on that.
Oh,
so.
Right.
He'd sort of seen me a little bit then, so that was very sweet. And he bought me a beer, which was very nice. And even though I'm pretty sure his beers were free, but anyway, I did say, I'm pretty sure you don't have to pay for your alcohol. Do you not think so? I'm like, I don't think so. Travis, do we have to buy beers? I don't know, dude. I'm like, oh, whatever. He goes, I'm just going to buy you a beer. I'm like, okay. But while I was standing at the bar prior to that and I'm buying myself a beer, I looked to my left and I was like, holy shit, that looks like Lester from this week's episode. I am so sure it's Lester from the, you know, ill-fated Lester from the episode number 2, 1002, Ruckenbach. Is that how you say it? And I quickly kind of pulled out my phone to Google the guest list to make sure it wasn't just a guy that looked remarkably like him. And sure enough, it was David Nichol, who was on Stargate, and he was in Arrow as well. He played a Russian Arrow and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, he played Lester. And just before I left, he was on his own, just sort of standing, which sometimes happens. And you're like, oh my God, one of the guests is on their own and you can swoop in. And, rather than surrounded by, it's amazing. Sometimes they're just standing there going la la la, and you're like, oh my God, no one's talking to them. How awkward. So I just went up and
they're standing there going, oh, thank God, I've got a moment to myself.
Just all these people around me.
Oops, I'm being swooped. Like at the park.
That was pretty much how I was. And so I made my way quickly over before anybody else got to him, and congratulated him on his performance on Supernatural that week, because this was the Friday night, and it had only just Friday night in Australia, so it was like the Thursday in the US, so it had only just gone to air a couple of days ago. And he was like, oh, thanks, sweetheart, thanks. Wait, in what? And I was like, oh, awkward moment. Supernatural, thinking, oh, my God, have I totally got, like, just the wrong person altogether? And he was like, oh, my God. And he had not seen it, and he hadn't seen the app, and he hadn't actually talked to anybody who had seen the app. So I was the first person that he'd spoken to who had actually seen his part in it. So he was like, how was it? And I told him what a great episode it was, and how the fans were like, went pretty crazy over that one. And, you know, it was a really, you know, sort of one of those
rare, popular.
Exactly. Very, very rare. I think I actually did say that. Rarely. Everybody liked it. We talked a little bit about it. He asked how he came across. I said it's complete sleaze, and he was like, awesome, that's what I was going for. And he talked a little bit about how he didn't realise when he took the job that, well, he didn't, for one, like how many people we hear this from, didn't even realise Supernatural was still on the air. And, I mean, he's in genre, so please. But then took the gig and didn't realise how big it was until after he'd become involved in it, and people obviously heard that he'd been involved in it, and he suddenly realized, he was like, you guys are everywhere. And I was like, yes, yes, we are. So we had a little conversation about fandom, and then he said to me, he said, so what scenes did you see? And I said, well, in the car, in the wife with the, you know, banging her boyfriend in front of you. And he's like, oh yeah, that was really funny. And I said, and in the car where Dean, you know, stabs you. And he's like, oh yeah, yeah, that was a really good scene. Oh, it was really great to do. And I was like, yeah, it was really fun. And he goes, so none of the other scenes, like the bar scene? And I went, what? What? No. I said, maybe that ended up, I said, you know, I don't know, maybe that didn't make the cut, you know, maybe it was a scene that they just didn't include. He goes, oh, no, that was a different episode. And I was like, what? And he, I know. And he was like, oh, yeah, I did, he said, I did the bar scenes and a couple of other scenes first. He said, I did them, Jensen directed them. And he said, and then I came back and did the other scenes. And I said, so you're in two episodes. And he goes, yeah. And I said, well, it's Jensen's episode next week. And he goes, oh, is it? And he said, but I shot, he said, I didn't understand how it was working because I shot those first and then I shot the other ones quite a bit later. And I said, yeah, well, they had to move Jensen's episode because, you know, he had to prep us. Oh, right. He goes, now it all comes together for me. He said, I had no idea how all these scenes fit together. He goes, now, oh, he goes, I suddenly understand how it all came together. And he goes, and I said, so you're in next week's episode. And he said, yes, I am. And I was like, you just gave me a massive spoiler. And he was like, yes, I did. Oh, never mind. Who cares? And I was like, oh, well, that's awesome. So, yeah, it was really, it was just really bizarre to sort of just run into him at this thing, yeah. Just a couple of days after watching the episode and actually have a chance to have a chat to him about, you know, working on the show and stuff. It was really cool.
Know that you were going to see him again and try and work out what that was all about.
I know, but it was like, and of course, as soon as, like, I'm texting you and then I'm back with you and we're trying to work out the storyline, and I think I had it pretty nutted out by the time I saw the episode. I was like, I actually did have it totally exactly what happened is what I'd pieced together from what he'd told me, and you know, and then somebody tweeted me a photo that had been a screen cap that had been from a very early promo. Of Sam with Lester and the Devil's Trap, and once you saw that, you know, it was kind of like, well, I know exactly what's happening now. I know what the bad thing Sam did was. So it was, but I would never have known that if I didn't run into, and no, then anybody who reads my blog would never have known that unless
and
I'd run
nice
into
for him to,
David.
And I know I, someone actually played the scene for him, or one of the scenes on their phone in Auckland.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Yeah, because he was really, he was like genuinely excited to talk to me about it because no one, he didn't even know it had gone to air at that point. So he hadn't seen it. He hadn't spoken to anybody who'd seen it. He didn't know how he'd come across. He didn't know if the episode was well received. He knew nothing. So he was like, oh my God, you know, he was so excited to talk to me about it. It was really funny.
Fantastic.
Yeah,
and that leads
cool.
us into talking about, because Amy and I unfortunately just had far too much fun last weekend. So
a little bit too fun.
We just didn't get time to.
And we had big intentions of doing that. We were in the same house, you know.
We were in the same house. So I also had to get up at bloody Sparrow's Fart on Sunday to do my TV Chinwag podcast with Mr. Ryan Curtis, who was getting himself all prettified to go off to the 200th episode party.
He needed lots of time to primp.
He did. And I must say he
scrubbed
up. He looked very fine.
He looked fine in that suit.
All suited up and looked very gorgeous. Mm-hmm. So it was well worth my sacrificing my sleep. Anyway,
I didn't sacrifice my sleep.
No, that was the only podcasting I got done. So we have two episodes to talk about.
They were crackers.
Reichenbach and Soul Survivor, mm-hmm. both of which starred Lester.
Both of which starred my pal Lester.
I will just now, if people hear squeaking in the background, it's my dog trying to use her Klingon translator to tell me that she'd like to go for a walk. So you'll just have to deal with it, because otherwise I'm going to have to run around the house and try and get it off her. Where shall we start? Shall we? Oh, I know where I want to start. I want to start right at the beginning of Reichenbach and the teaser sequence where we go back to 2003.
Oh, yes.
Where a young Cole wakes up and hears a ruckus downstairs and goes down the stairs to see his father dead on the floor. I loved the sequence for a number of reasons. There's a little detail when Cole gets to the bottom of the stairs and he slips in his father's blood.
Yeah, that was really... I don't know if
that was planned or unplanned. The episode was directed by Thomas Wright, who I know is one of the regular directors on the show. He's a great director, and so maybe that was a direction, but it was just that little moment
really
where
nice.
It really makes the whole thing very real.
Very and horrible. It's like horrible.
Yeah. Slipping his bed, you know, this kid barefoot out of bed, slipping in his father's blood.
Yeah, it's awful.
And then we get Dean appears, you know, he looks up as he's crying over his father's body and he looks up and who's in the doorway but Dean. And it's a young Dean. It's 2003.
It's like pre-Dean. It's Dean we've never seen before, really.
Yes, we've never seen. No, you're right. We've never seen 2003 Dean. This is when he and John were off, hunting together and
exactly.
Sam was at Stanford.
Yep. So he's like 24, we assume.
Yes.
And he'd been computer fixed. How do I get those compositors to follow me around, Jules? I need them to follow me around and iron my face out on a daily basis. Can that happen? How does that happen?
So it was actually Jensen and they'd used a technique called compositing to youngify him. I think that was the technical term VFX supervisor Mark Maloche used was youngified.
Yes, which I believe is the technical term.
And I think they looked... Obviously, it didn't look like Jensen looked in 2003, but I think they did an amazing job, and it was great to see Dean in Dad's leather jacket with the amulet on again.
Yeah, that was really interesting.
So I would encourage them to do that whenever they can because it's just so special back to that moment. And I'm sure, obviously, as Cole's storyline hasn't been resolved at the moment, we will get, we might even get more flashbacks and more story about, more insight into what happened.
What his father was or what his father did or why his father ended
whether Dean killed him or not. I mean,
Dean
and a dead body in the same house doesn't mean Dean killed him.
No, I think there's a pretty good chance Dean did not kill him and was hunting the thing that did kill him. But, you know, we will find out. Because I don't think Dean was killing humans at that point in time. I don't think.
Well, he mightn't have been a human per se.
Exactly.
He could have been a werewolf.
He could have been a monster, in which case, fine.
You know, he could have been anything. So,
Or killed by something that Dean was hunting.
Exactly. So there are many, many explanations. Probably the only thing we know... it was unlikely to have been a demon. Or it could have been a demon, but Dean didn't really know about demons back then.
No, I don't think so. Plain old everyday monsters.
That's yet to be unravelled.
Yes.
But I thought it was, you know, it was a great... And then we flip forward to Dean in the present day in a strip club with, I think it was Sweet Cherry Pie playing, wasn't it?
Yeah, Cherry Pie, which he's... Last time he was watching strippers to Cherry Pie, it was in his dreams when he was watching the angels and an angel stripper and a devil stripper dance before the angel Anna burst into his brains.
Yes.
That's one of my all-time favourite scenes.
A song he strongly associates
with strippers. that original Cherry Pie sequence is one of my favourites. That was really cool. So I was really excited to hear that. That was my ringtone for the longest time. Everybody used to always laugh when it went off at work.
Little did they know you were a stripper in your spare time.
That's it. My real name's Jasmine. So we get to see Dean, and it was lovely to that there was the nice intercutting of the Dean beating up the bouncer who was trying to stop him feeling up the stripper, and intercut with Sam getting beaten by Cole, who still had Sam hostage and was still trying to get information out of him. That, I thought that sequence was really well put together, because whenever we cut back to Dean, you had the music. Oh. When we cut to Sam, there was no music. It was
editing.
It was such a nicely put together sequence, beautifully edited.
And, of course, it played off the conversation that was going on with Sam and Cole, where Sam finally says, you know, that, you know,
Dean's not Dean.
Dean's not Dean, and that there are monsters out there. And Cole has the line that, you know, yeah, I was in the armed forces, you know, I've been to places, I've seen
monsters. Don't tell me about monsters.
And Sam's like, yeah, not that quite a monster.
Vampires and werewolves. And Dean's like, whatever, crazy person.
Which, again, I always love those outsider point of view when you get, hey, guys, you sound batshit crazy.
Yeah.
But I did, you know, again, it layers, and obviously what's going to be a big theme of this season of, you know, what defines a monster. You know, here we've got both Cole and Sam talking about monsters. We've got Dean being a demon, being a monster, and you've also got Cole, who's a human,
monstrous,
holding Sam hostage and torturing him. And we, as the episode goes on, this episode and the next episode, we'll start to find out what Sam's done when he was trying to find Dean, and so that's obviously going to be a big
what happened with that shoulder. Because I actually watched episode, I was saying to Jules that before we did this podcast, it was a very hot day today in Sydney, and I was out all morning and came home and hid in my air conditioning, and watched episode 1, 2, and 3 of the season back to back, which please do that if you get a chance to, because they play beautifully together. They're like just to be continued from one bit to the other. But it reminded me of the conversation that Cass had about Jared, Sam's shoulder. You know, don't blame me that you were out of, he said, you know, you and the demon, you were out of. And he's like, I'm not blaming you. And I was like, you were? I forgot about that conversation. So it'll be interesting to see what was happening when Sam busted his shoulder.
Yeah, they may never refer back to it.
They may never, but, you know, that might be one of the things we flash back to see how naughty Sam was in looking for Dean.
Which we certainly get, more of during these episodes. And then, of course, Sam gets loose, and I didn't actually think at the time. I thought he had just got loose. I didn't realise that Lester had set it up. Cole. So Cole is not to be underestimated.
No, he's pretty smart. I mean, I didn't realise that at first. I thought, well, that's pretty slack on his behalf just to drop his keys like that. But then, and then finding out, I was like, oh, he's a smart cookie. He played the whole thing because he knew the first thing Sam would do would be going to look for Dean. That's what he's doing. So,
which is exactly what Sam does.
And he leads Cole right to Dean, much to, not necessarily to his advantage.
No. And then, of course, we have the scene with Dean and Crowley where... we get one of the little Easter eggs. Someone mentioned this that we should say on Twitter. There have been some little Easter eggs in the episodes. And in the first episode, and look, God love the person who, or I should say Chuck loved the person who picked this up. But in the first episode in the bar, Dean's sitting at a table, and I think he's talking to, waitress's name that he slept with, Amanda?
I can't remember.
I will tell you in just a minute because
I've got the wiki open.
Well, so Anne-Marie,
that's it,
Anne-Marie. And so when he's sitting at a table and she walks past and says something to him, on the table, rather than salt and pepper, it's two pepper shakers.
Oh, that's really cool. I didn't notice the pepper shakers.
And, of course, you know, Dean being a demon, the great line on Tumblr was, someone in set deck has been waiting 4 months for that joke to pay off.
Absolutely.
And then you had the wonderful, in this scene we pick up with Dean and Crowley in this episode, and Dean orders Crowley a drink, and it's a frou-frou cocktail, and there's a little devil's trident in it.
That was awesome too. Yeah,
absolutely adorable.
Yeah.
while Dean has a couple of shots. Mm-hmm. And Crowley convinces him to go, of course, as Amy's already discussed, go and take out, satisfy the Mark of Cain by killing Mindy.
Yep.
Because Lester's made a deal with the demon and his soul is due. Of course, then as we find out in the next episode, he made that deal because of bum, 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 Sam. And it's interesting because there's just before Dean leaves in that bar scene, before he leaves, Crowley says, and one other thing, and then we cut. These things don't always mean something, but that seems so.
Yeah, it was like what's the other thing?
What did he tell him?
Well, now we know.
Now we know he told him that it was actually Sam who used Lester to summon a crossroads demon, so he could capture her, and that was the. In the opening of the season premiere, when we saw him torturing the demon Dar, that was the demon that he'd captured by using Lester.
Mm-hmm.
Who in the process ended up selling his soul, and then Dean ended up killing him.
Because he was obviously a scumbag anyway, but...
Well, yeah, I don't know that he, deserved to lose his soul and
die. I don't think that either. But, he certainly jumped at the opportunity, kill my wife and have my soul. But, yes, we can talk about whether, because a lot of people were like, I don't think that was such a bad thing that Sam did, but I think it was a pretty bad thing myself.
Yes.
I personally think it was pretty awful. But we can talk about that when we get there. I agree with you. I'm like, oh, that was not a good thing. But a lot of people are like, that wasn't so bad. I'm like, are you serious? That was pretty bad. But
people have been hanging around the Winchesters too long, and your moral line in the sand starts slipping. You're like, oh, and he had a really ugly mustache.
And, I know, and it was creepy. Really nice person, it's okay.
Shout out, though. It was, Lester was obviously a reference to, either the TV show or the film movie of Fargo.
He actually was similar.
Sorry?
He was very similar in character.
So, a similar sort of character.
Yeah.
The guy who thinks the world's against him and then puts in things motion to try, in this case, try and get his wife killed unsuccessfully.
Well, yeah.
In this case, the Winchesters intervened.
Yes.
and took things their own way. Of course, we have Cole continues to track down Sam, and Dean goes back to tell Crowley that he's killed Lester, and that was a great scene
because
it's the first, it's a rare thing to see someone take things up to Crowley, and Dean is just in full demon fuck you mode.
I actually said, and I will say this now, I think this was the sexiest episode that Supernatural has ever made. And everybody was closed and no one was having sex. But good God almighty. I was just like, oh, my God. I think when I went on Twitter afterwards, I was like, is it just me? Or does anyone else need to have a cold shower? Seriously, if I smoked, I would have lit up after I watched that episode. It was something else. And that moment when Crowley goes, don't you turn your back on me, and Dean turns around, I was like, oh, my God. No, I must have replayed that 500 times. That was awesome. And Jensen's just like, excuse me, stop it with the Demon Dean thing. It's just amazing. In all ways, performance ways, and hotness. So I'll say it, it's amazing. But that scene was great, and just the little power punch as he pushes Crowley to the ground. But I couldn't help but wondered if this was all part of Crowley's manipulation or what was going on there, because it was all like,
never underestimate
exactly, and never know what's going on with him. Can I also mention, I really loved the demon with the flock of seagulls hairdo. The girl,
she's hot.
I loved her hair.
I'll take her.
I was like, I love her flock of seagulls hair.
I was disappointed when she wasn't back in the next episode. I could certainly, she can have my soul. what's left of it. It was
left of it.
been selling it off piece by piece.
Oh my god!
For those that even think I had one in the first place, of course, that's another issue. But no, one wonderful scene, and you know, this whole relationship between Crowley and Dean, you know, and the of course we ended the episode with Crowley sitting alone and lonely girl playing.
Possibly the best music cue ever. Look, well, longingly looking at the photo of him and Dean wearing cowboy
hats, like flicking through his phone of the memories, he was just
so sad. But I just loved all the stuff he said to Dean. You know, it's, you know, it's the, what did he say? It's the crazy ones or something, you know, that you can't have a relationship, and it's not me, it's you. And Dean's like, are you finished? You know, it was just beautiful. It was like, it was the end of a romance.
Well, yeah. And I think, you know, again, it's, we saw, you know, bits of Crowley's humanity the end of season 8. And, you know, it's a lonely job being the ruler of hell.
This is what I think. I think Crowley, and especially when we see him in the next episode in Soul Survivor, I genuinely think Crowley is a bit lonely. And I think having whether he's still touched by his humanity, but re-experiencing humanity and then having like a buddy to hang out with, now all of a sudden he's on his own again, and he must have been on his own for a very long time before that and probably didn't care, but now he does. And I think it's really interesting. I think Crowley's lonely.
Well, a few things I think with Crowley. I don't even know whether this is the result of him getting in touch with his humanity. I expect, like, you know, for a long time, Crowley was obviously, you know, for a while, he obviously was just being a crossroads demon and doing his job, but obviously was always ambitious. And, you know, then there was a sort of fight where, you know, and clawing his way up and becoming, you know, king of hell. But, you know, now he doesn't. And then he had the time when he was working with Cass. And now he doesn't, you know, he doesn't have any peers around him. I mean, he even had Abaddon as an adversary. It's just, you know, we've often speculated the fact that, you know, he has always really kept the Winchesters alive when he could have killed them many times.
And vice versa.
You know, he doesn't, at the moment, he doesn't have any grand plans. It's not like when he was trying to find purgatory or anything. So there's no big project to keep him busy. He's back to the mundane day-to-day of running hell.
Yeah.
He got to go and howl at the moon with Dean. And, yeah, and I think that was more fun than, you know, and they've made that point of the again of the bureaucracy of hell and him having to listen to really, really boring shit.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there's genuine connection there with Dean, and so I think he does feel dumped and rejected, and you know, it's not how he envisaged this was going to go.
Yeah, exactly. And I think he's genuinely, I don't know if hurt's the right word, but, you know, he's certainly genuinely put out when Dean kind of says, we're not besties, and I'm not taking orders from you. And I think he realises, you know, the party's over. He'd probably been thinking that for a while, but, you know, he obviously realised then and then that it was done and dusted. But, yeah, that was such a great scene. Such a great scene. I loved it.
And we, you know, I'm jumping ahead to the next episode here, but
they're kind of one of a, you know, like they're like
it's a continuous story.
Yeah.
You know, when he saves Cass, and I think that's interesting about, you know, he says he saves Cass because he wants Dean taken down and says he's not sentimental.
So I sentimental.
I don't think that's true at all.
I think he's awfully sentimental.
I think he has some ulterior motive.
Oh, I do too. Oh, my God. He's got something. I mean, the fact that he just has the blade worries the crap out of me.
Yes. I think that was not a good move on Sam's part.
I think it was all part of Crowley's, you know, whatever his, when the plans weren't going to his way. I think that was his plan B. Plan A was Dean. That didn't work out. What's plan B? And plan B involves the blade.
Yes, and I think, you know, I'm not sure why he saved Cass. I think part of it is because he thought Cass could probably actually help bring Dean back and keep him alive, that maybe on his own Sam wouldn't be able to save Dean, if you like. But it certainly wasn't because he thought you know, was hoping Cass would kill Dean. And yes. I think he knows both Sam and Cass better than that to know that would be the last thing on earth they do if they could possibly avoid it. I'm sure we will find out. There's always a hidden agenda with Crowley.
And we haven't really found out. Crowley really has been... In the beginning of the season, he's really been pushing everybody else's story along. Yes. And we haven't actually seen what's happening with him. He's been sort of, he's been the person moving Dean's arc along, moving the Sam and Dean arc along, and moving Cass's arc along, but we haven't actually seen what Crowley is up to yet.
No, except it's going to be something.
It'll be something, and we'll go, damn him.
but we skipped ahead there really on Cass's storyline.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I started it. Cass's storyline from, with his fading grace and with, you know, he's agreed to help Hannah find these rogue angels. He then gets caught up again in trying to help Dean. And I loved, particularly in this week's episode, this episode in Reichenbach, the interactions with Hannah, and in a way how Hannah's a bit of a place marker for us remembering what Cass was like in season four. You know, she's very much still the very literal angel. She's the soldier. She's the one who doesn't understand the ways of humans. And we see, by having her there, we see how far Cass has come and how human in his ways and his understandings of people and of the world Cass has come. So I think that's a really, particularly given how many iterations we've had of Cass.
Yeah.
Right? I think it's a really nice way of saying, remember when Cass was like this. Now look at how Cass is. That's a big shift.
And I think I was thinking about that as well, and in this week's episode as well, and some of the things that he said to Hannah in this week's episode, which were reflections of what he's learnt of what people do and how people to react to things and how emotions, you know, cloud judgments and things like that. And I thought, how interesting this is that we've got an angel teaching another angel about human emotions and what it is to feel and what that means and, you know, what to be careful of. I actually think I'm really enjoying their relationship and, you know, their sort of growing, you know, their interactions and their growing relationship. And I'm really enjoying that aspect of Cass sort of being the one who actually is so human, but he's in so many ways he's still so not human, and yet, you know, he can teach her all of these things. And I think it's really interesting. I'm finding that the interactions between them really interesting, and I really enjoyed it in episode two, like when the tow truck woman was really kind to her and said, you know, there's surprise bean salad or whatever it was in the fridge, and she was like, oh, you're being very kind. And she was so surprised that humans were actually could be kind to people in need. And, you know, Cass's interaction with the little girl and her very special snot, and, you know, having and her seeing that,
was such a gorgeous moment.
That was great, wasn't it? That was one of my favorite lines ever, I think. But, you know, seeing her see all that stuff is like, especially when she was, you know, coming at humanity and what had to happen from a very different angle when we first met her, and watching her learn, just as Cass has learned over the last years, and struggle with, you know, what emotion means and how an angel deals with that in their world, is I'm finding that I'm really enjoying it.
We saw Cass get to a point last season where he'd accepted a role of leadership and was thought that he could do this again differently, but now he's still trying to help. I thought it was very clever the way we've got him some extra time. We were allowed to see what fading grace does and how terrible the effect on him was. Now he's had a bit of a reboost, but we know that's only a temporary save, if you like. It'll be interesting to see what happens next. It was bittersweet to have him, I love the fact that he, turned up to save the day with Dean and
save Sam.
Getting a hammer to the head. And when, you know, that line he has when he's talking to Sam about, you know, maybe this was better than living with the pain, was just,
well,
you know, I think that was crystallized everything, you know, that Cass really has learned about being human is what it's like to feel that sort of pain.
But also I think that was something that soulless Sam, you know, went through as well. The, you know, the why do I want, you know, those conversations where Dean was like, you sit in the dark and you suffer because that's what you do as you're
like,
human. And Sam's like, well, why would I want to do that? And part of the reason that Sam, you know, it was, well, yeah, sure, he knew that he might have gone crazy if he got his soul shoved back in, but I think there was also a part of him that, you know, this was like Dean, this is a way, you know, you're not feeling how much the Winchesters feel a hell of a lot, and, you know, the not feeling must be a blessed relief.
Yes.
Yeah. So what Cass said, I think that they probably both, oh, my dog just pulled my earphones off my head, probably both, you know, have very much dealt with in their own ways. But yeah, I was glad that Cass got re-angelified. Yeah, because he was just so weak, and I was like, I didn't know. I like a really powerful Cass. I just like Cass. And, you know, I thought to myself when, sorry, my dog's totally tangled in my earphones. Sorry about that, everybody. When I thought to myself, when he arrived and grabbed the snarling Dean, and his eyes all lit up blue, it was so, super cool. I thought to myself, you know, Sam had like taken the knife away from Dean's throat and backed away, but he probably had seen Cass coming, or, you know, because Cass can't zap because he has no angel wings, as we discussed on Twitter this week. So maybe he actually saw, because I was like, oh God, he's not going to do it, and now Dean's going to kill him, and then Cass arrived, and I was like, hang on, he probably saw Cass coming down the hall and thought, phew, okay, I don't have to kill my brother, and Cass is going to come and, you know, grab him before I have to do anything about it. So I wonder what would have happened if Cass didn't show up.
Not good things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Very not good things, I would
to
think.
To one of them, yeah.
Yeah, no, it was the best well-timed arrival.
Oh, it was a very good, very well-timed arrival. Yeah.
Oh, now we've jumped all over the place. Now we should go back to Dean and Sam's confrontation in Reichenbach.
That was awesome too.
Oh, heartbreakingly awesome.
I've got to say, Jensen, in that scene when he mocked Sam's, you know.
Oh. I'm here to take you home.
With this little break in his voice, I'm going to take you home. And it was just like, I'm like, oh my God.
Him and goes, ha-ha.
Yeah, I know. And it's like with the puppy eyes, and you even, it almost looked like it hit Sam, you know, like he kind of winced when Dean said that. But it was so beautiful. I've got to say that the interactions between Sam and Dean in that episode, like, at the end of Reichenbach and in the car, and then following in Soul Survivor, it's just those boys just bounce off each other so beautifully, and that their work is so wonderful. And that scene was just delicious. Right from the beginning, when we saw Dean sitting at the piano cutting his hand and watching it heal, you know, and I think that's when he picked a side. You know, yeah. Crowley had said, pick a side, and are you human or are you demon? And he's sitting there cutting his hand, his eyes go black, and he watches his hand heal, and then Sam walks in, and I was like, whoop, that he just picked a side. And because from that moment on, I think before then, not so, a little bit in Reichenbach, but definitely in the first episode of the season, there was still this kind of ambivalence towards of Demon Dean, where he kind of still had this lingering Deanness that was, you know, he was a demon and he was, you know, really violent and stuff, but he was still kind of had something Deany about him. But from that moment on, he'd ceased to be Dean. Mm-hmm. He just all the Deanness, apart from looking like Dean and having very sassy, snappy comebacks. He just didn't have anything left of Dean. And Demon Dean smiled so much. He was smiling all the time.
Isn't it interesting that, you know, that was more than anything the thing that made him feel not like Dean.
He just smiled so much.
We so rarely see Dean smile that, seeing him be happy-go-lucky and carefree and smiling and, you know, even his body was, you know, more relaxed and, you know, all that made him, foreign to us.
Very foreign. And then his smile towards the end there, like in, you know, with Cole and with Sam in the confrontation with Sam, there was, you know, no mirth, no nothing behind that smile, but malice. And you know, it was really interesting to watch. I thought that scene was fantastic. The scene with Sam, and then the following fight with Cole was like a dance.
Oh, that was magically choreographed. Both the fight coordination and stunt work on that
was beautiful.
So well done. You've got, you know, Cole in this desperate, you know, trying to kill Dean, and him just, you know, flitting around lightly, you know, stepping out of the way of the blows, pirouetting.
Pirouetting.
He was. Practically. Not a care in the world.
It was beautiful. It was like a ballet. And there was the point too when Cole just yelled out in frustration, and I thought that was fantastic, you know, like just this bellow that came out of him just because he just couldn't make any headway with Dean at all. And it was just amazing scene. It was an amazing, and then of course it had probably what I personally think was the best pop culture reference ever, that the history of the show.
I think fandom's with you on that one.
That Dean watches The Princess Bride. Woohoo! That's awesome. That was awesome.
And it was so appropriate for the moment.
It was brilliant.
You know, just the tone and everything. He did it so well.
That was fantastic. I think I jumped up and down and cheered or something. I don't know. It was one of my all-time favourite movies, and I was just like, you're kidding me. That was so good.
I just wanted to go back for a moment because another thing I loved was when he was at the piano, I'm sure most of fandom were like hoping for a Dark Angel-esque moment of him actually playing the piano. And those notes apparently are the first opening notes of Hey Jude, which of course is what his mother used to sing to him.
Aww. See, there he was, definitely picking a side.
Yes. So again, love a little Easter egg there for us to pick up on.
Yeah, very, very nice. And then we had Sam capturing him with the holy water. I'm pretty sure that was probably the first time Dean ever felt holy water.
Yes, I would say so.
Mm. And locking him down, which was, good.
And then the line that really confirmed how far Dean had fallen was when he said, you know, Sam commented on the fact that Dean had not been taking care of the Impala, and he said, it's just a car.
Just a car, Sam. And even Sam, it's just a car. Wow. Wow, you've really gone dark.
Now, I wanted to address something a lot of people asked me on Twitter, and I think we had a question again today. People seemed real, and I'm not sure why, people seemed really confused by the title of this episode, Reichenbach, which, for those of you who don't realise, Sherlock Holmes does actually predate Benedict Cumberbatch. Now, there was, of course, the famous episode, though, of the BBC Sherlock called Reichenbach Fall, which is when Moriarty and Sherlock have their confrontation on the roof, and we think that Sherlock has fallen to his death.
Yep.
It is, of course, based on the original, you know, story of Sherlock Holmes, and what happened was Arthur Conan Doyle wanted to kill off Sherlock Holmes. He was sick of writing him. He was sick of having him around, and so he wrote a story, a number of the Sherlock Holmes stories. They were novels, but there were many short stories, and there was a short story called The Final Problem where Holmes confronts his nemesis Moriarty on the actual Reichenbach Falls in Switzerland, and apparently falls to his death. In what I think is a nice little bit of meta relating to Supernatural, really, Conan Doyle's fans were so outraged that he killed off Sherlock that they basically, you know, hounded him into bringing him back. But I think the name of the episode being Reichenbach simply refers to Cole, you know, who's had these years and years of plotting his revenge on Dean, finally getting to confront his nemesis. You can, of course, also, you know, there are a number of other relationships in this which you could see as sort of reflecting that as well. But, you know, I think essentially it's about Cole, you know, finally getting to confront Dean and failing.
For the moment,
He does, of course, find out that Dean's a demon and
weirdly goes to the library.
Stumbles off bloody into the nearest library and can't quite work out the Dewey Decimal System code for demon possession. Sorry, it's
interwebs, Carl, interwebs.
Little criticism there. I think perhaps they could have had him sitting in his car with his laptop open.
Yes, I think he probably could have done that.
Slightly less
dramatic.
But
then he does have a fax and everybody freaked out about that
as well.
Well,
that's true.
He's fairly old school.
Slightly less dramatic. But...
then, yeah, and wiping blood across a whole lot of books while a shocked librarian looks on. that was pretty cool. And then, of course, we also had the conversation with Dean in the car and Sam thinking that Dean had shown Cole mercy and Dean showing his, you know, how cold he really is, explained that no, completely the opposite. He did the worst thing he could ever do to Cole by letting him live and, you know, having missed the chance to kill Dean after wanting to kill him for so many years. And, you know, it was, I think, Sam's face. I was just watching Sam's face of Sam going, oh, shit. You know, yeah. It was like, oh, shit, what have I got in the backseat? It was like, oh, my God. Yeah, so I thought that was fantastic. Fantastic little piece in the back. And Wade Dean just sort of said, you know, and what I'm going to do to you will be no mercy either, Sam. And he's just looking out the window calmly, sort of like, yep, I'm going to kill you. And that's just that.
It was an amazing episode.
It was an amazing episode.
Big shout out to Andrew Dabb. That
brilliant
was just
script.
Seriously, it didn't let up. I think I tweeted at the time, I think I've just held my breath for the whole hour. I mean,
it was fantastic. I think, you know, like, became an instant favourite for mine, instant, and I watched it over and over that week. And, you know, like I said, I watched it again today, and... I honestly think it's one of the best the series has done. It was as near perfect as Supernatural ever gets.
Yeah, no, it really knocked it out of the water. And then, as you say, as we've been saying, it really was sort of, well, the first three have really been one story.
Yep.
And I've
really enjoyed that. It's kind of like being, I know some people have been saying it's a very slow burn, the beginning of this season, but, you know, each episode has been really high-paced, high power, and highly emotional, certainly for us.
Yeah, and I think, as I said in the first, when we were talking about the first episode, what I like is that we're getting time to really pin down where these characters are emotionally.
So I love it.
Jumping straight into a case of the week or whatever, and you know, that will happen next week, and we'll have a few of those. But I really feel we've had a lot of time because, you know, as Jeremy Carver said, this season's going to be personal. So we've spent a lot of time really getting deep into where these characters are at the moment, a bit of the backstory that we didn't see, you know, from before the season's picked up, but really knowing where they're at the moment and spending a lot more time on that, which, you know, in some ways is a bit of a luxury, and I'm glad they've taken the time to do that.
Yeah, but I am too.
You know, it's been one story for three episodes with no sort of diversions.
I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And, it has kind of felt like this sort of slowly unravelling this story, but each episode has been such... has been really pacey, and I think the pacing of all three episodes has been beautiful, and the pacing of these three episodes together as one long story has been really great. I think that, you know, this is by far and away one of the strongest starts to any season that the show has done.
Of course, we start Soul Survivor with Sam in the dungeon with Dean. We started actually with Sam getting blessed.
Dr. Sexy MD.
Sorry?
He was Dr. Sexy MD.
I have to say, I note every time we've had to have Sam, the few times we've had Sam in a lab coat, they have to make them so big for him.
Oh, it's such
like
a big lad.
Huge.
And he didn't have his sling on.
No.
Either. No. So doctor can't have sling, obviously. Though he did not use that arm at all, I noticed.
No. And I think we have slinged Sam for another episode.
Yes, we do.
After this one.
Yeah.
But, so he very cleverly went and found a priest who'd come in and bless a whole lot of blood
priest,
just before.
The priest looked a bit sweaty and weirded out.
Don't know how he convinced the priest to do that. No, he looked a little
weirded out by that doctor, and he almost ran out the door.
And I loved it was sort of a call back to changing channels with the doctor, father.
Doctor. Yeah, father.
But very clever on Sam's part, I think.
Yes, to, it was smart, Sam.
Go and get, not knowing how much blood he's going to need. Of course, there was enormous wank around about the blood.
Oh, I saw that.
Because, of course, you will remember, everyone will remember so clearly that when Sam buries John's dog tags back in season two in Children Shouldn't Play With Dead Things, for that millisecond there on screen, we actually notice that John Winchester was blood type AB and had no religious affiliation. Just thought I'd throw that in there. So people, of course, picked up on this, and the fact that Sam said to Dean, I even got your blood type, which was type O that he'd picked up, and it would be highly unusual for someone with blood type AB to have a child who was type O. So people took this to mean it was a secret squirrel clue that John Winchester was not Dean's father.
Well, I know, I can't believe that.
Which, you know, creative thinking fandom, I always give points for creative thinking. Mm-hmm. Of course, what I took it to mean when Sam said I got your blood type was I got a donor that would match you.
Yeah.
Rather than just shoving any old blood type into you because, hey, we don't know how this is going to go down. So I might as well at least get a type that if you are human isn't going to kill you.
It's not going to kill you. Exactly.
So I did end up giving a few lectures on the inheritance of blood types and also blood donations on the internet because I'm really helpful like that.
And O being the universal blood type, right?
Well, for donations, yes. Yes. Unless you're rhesus type negative and it's O positive, that's another thing. But anyway, generally, universal donor. So getting past that, we start
fandom,
seriously. And we should mention, of course...
Of all things to take out of this episode.
Yes. God love your fandom.
Oh, my gosh.
We need to mention, of course, and you might talk us through it, Amy, because I know he's talked about it a bit, was Jensen was directing this episode, and he has talked quite a bit about the challenge because, of course, they filmed it first.
Yes.
So he had to be Demon Dean or, you know, an iteration of Demon Dean in this episode without having played Demon Dean.
Yes.
And one can only imagine, I mean, that's an acting challenge in and of itself.
Yeah, he actually did talk about this a little bit in the meet and greet that I did with him in Vancouver. So a couple of people asked him about Demon Dean, because obviously at that point in time we had yet to see Demon Dean, and also asked him about directing the episode. And he did talk about the particular challenges of this episode, one being the fact that he had to create what he considered a completely new character. Demon Dean was something totally new, and he was having to go into the first episode of the season clean off hiatus after having a break and, you know, being out of the headspace altogether anyway, have to create a whole new character while also directing a very complex episode. And he spoke about, I mean, Dean was in this episode a lot, and sure, part of it he was tied to a chair, but still he was, you know, there was a lot of Dean in this episode, and a lot of Dean dialogue in this episode that he had to get his chops around. And then, of course, you had the very complex cat and mouse chase down the halls of the bunker, which he spoke about being quite difficult because he had to make it look like the bunker halls were this massive maze and this bunker went for miles under the mountain, and really there's only like a couple of halls, and they had to keep redressing them to make them look like different halls and going on to different doors because it's not as big as what it appeared to be in the shoot. And so having to map that out, and he actually did map it out. He talked about how he actually sat down with blueprints and mapped the whole thing out like a map route.
Coming from someone like me who has a very poor spatial sense, that's incredible to me because, you know, yes, he's basically got, you know, a limited physical space to move with, and then to map out how to use, the camera shots to make it look so much bigger.
Yeah.
and how they would go, which bits they'd extend where, because I understand they have sort of modules,
yep,
corridor modules they can clip onto either end, and how they do that is, yeah, it's amazing.
And, yeah, he said that for he always, you know, is prepared. He always comes to set when he directs. He says, with all 8 days of his shoot prepared, already mapped out, shot listed, yep, worked through, because he always has to act as well. So he's not like other directors where he can think on the fly. He doesn't have that luxury because he has another job to do as well. So he makes sure that he's super organized. But he said in this case, he, you know, put together his like director's binder, and he said he had to make it to the point where he knew he could hand it off to Brad, or I think it was, as he mentioned, Brad. So hand it off to Brad and sort of say, okay, here's the next bunch of shots. I'm going to go be Demon Dean.
Yeah.
Because he had to concentrate so much on creating this new character that he couldn't, you know, spend the time going through
flipping in and out every
flipping in
seconds.
And out of yeah, being director to Dean to director to Dean, which he's had to do in the past, and which he has honestly said has always been quite a challenge to him to flip in and out of those headspaces. And he says he can only do it because he knows Dean so well, and Dean is such second nature to him. But of course, this Dean wasn't. This Dean was all totally new. So he needed to prep the episode to such a degree that he could just hand it off and just trust, you know, that the people he worked with understood what he wanted and would get it all. And he said at the end of their, you know, when they'd done the setup and the scenes that he was doing, he'd sit down and go, okay, did we get everything? And they'd go through everything they'd got, and they'd go, okay, we just missed this. And then they'd go back and do that. So he, it sounded, you know, really challenging. He said the whole thing was very, very challenging. And of course, he was also creating Dean at the Demon Dean at the same time.
Amazing.
He is amazing. He's amazeballs.
And I do want to add in, because I like to bring that little bit extra to our podcast. Of course, Amy, you might want to comment from a viewer's point of view about his portrayal of Dean, particularly the growls.
Oh, the growl. Well, the growl was fantastic. And, I mean, he was – what I picked up on the growl was that it – no longer sounded human. So, which I think was really interesting, because if you think about, you know, classic kind of demonic horror movies, the demons often are, you know, have those kind of non-human sounds. And we've really not heard that before from demons in Supernatural, because they're always, you know, quite human and we don't hear them do that. But Dean's growls were particularly guttural and sounded to me like they had something else mixed in them, like an animal or, you know, some kind of tweaking to the audio mixed in just to enhance Jensen's, you know, big deep growl to give it that kind of inhuman sound.
Well, interesting you say that, because I did ask Todd Araneau, who's the post-production producer and very heavily involved in the sound, and he said, to quote him, they did add some special sauce, but it was basically all Jensen.
It's pretty good.
Pretty amazing, because I just thought those challenges of, as you've just talked about, the acting and directing, but you know, that must be quite hard to push yourself, you know, to work out, because that's what he was portraying. You know, you can easily take that too far and it becomes cheesy, or you don't take it far enough and it's just like,
and it's not threatening, yeah.
So, and to have to direct yourself doing that with, and look, I suppose the thing is, we've got to remember that, you know, Jensen's in this, you know, team of people he's worked with for 10 years. He's got Jared there as well. He's got, you know,
yeah, Brad, and he trusts them to tell them if he hasn't got it.
Yes, and so I imagine he is in part relying on one, you know, them letting him know to some extent if it's, you know,
and of course
too
he can
far
also,
or not far enough.
But and of course he still, goes cut and goes and watches it as well.
Yeah, but you know, all power to him, because I think, as you say, he took it to a different place than we've seen Demon, so it was very unique. And it was both scary in a couple of ways. Scary because he was being a demon, but also because, you know, there was that echo of pain in it. We don't know what the blood cure is doing to Dean, as you know, and as it turns out, Sam doesn't even, you know, doesn't know if he could be killing him. And all that comes out in those growls, I think.
And
it's, you know, scary. It is a wounded animal sound.
It was. It sounded really animalistic, and I thought that was fantastic, you know, because he's no longer human anymore, and that was coming across very, very clearly through those growls. And I think what the scariest for me, I actually found this episode one of the scariest that the show has done, and I think that purely was because it was Dean, and to see him be this otherworldly creature, and then to see him just be this hell bent on bashing choosing a hammer to.
Oh, and to, look, whoever came up with. Brilliant. I'm assuming that was in the script, because.
I'm assuming, but it'd be
so
interesting
much
question.
More brutal than anything else.
Oh, it was so, just amazing. And there he's got, like, the cleaver, and he picks it up, and then he kind of smirks to himself because he sees the hammer. And that's just so much worse. And it's like, oh my God, he's chasing his brother down and hitting him in the head with a hammer.
You use a cleaver to kill someone, you use a hammer
to beat them to death,
maximum pain.
You know, and I, you know, I found the whole episode really scary, and I think it's because this was Dean, and this was Dean, you know, and he was this whole other thing, and he was terrifying.
Yeah.
Just terrifying.
He did that so well.
So well. His Demon Dean, and I mean, we don't know what's going to happen. You know, obviously, we'll probably chat a little about what we think will happen. You know, what the hanging thing is around Dean now. But you know, we don't know where he's going to go or what's going to happen with Dean as we progress into the season. But these three episodes and watching the development of Demon Dean from this kind of half human, half demon Dean to this full blown animalistic something, you know, very foreign to us creature which has nothing about Dean about it, was just wonderful to watch that progression. And to think it went backwards. He had to do it backwards. He did, you know, the end first. The outcome before he did the beginning.
Yes.
So then,
although in some ways, although obviously, narratively, it is the climax. The Dean we see in this episode is quite distinct from the Dean in, you know, episodes, you know, one and two.
Yeah, very much. It's a very different Dean.
Yes, he's not cracking jokes and playing, you know, foosball.
No, he's fighting for his life.
Yes.
Pretty much. Yeah. And, you know, like, he can't do anything but verbally retaliate because he's tied down and, you know, in a devil's trap and he can't escape. But, you know, everything he's doing basically is fighting for his life in the only way that he can. And then once he's up and around, he's just like, oh, well, I did tell you if you let me go, I would have let you alone. But, hey, you didn't.
And, look, I just, you know, on the other side of this, we've got Sam. And I think, you know, Sam's probably never had greater courage in a way than having to face Dean taunting him and abusing him in the way he does in this. And the fact that Sam can keep his cool and, you know, he obviously it's hitting him, it's hitting a mark with him, but that he can, you know, keep his cool and keep doing what he has to do is just incredible.
I don't think I've ever loved Sam quite as much as I have right now. He's just been amazing. And just seeing him stand firm and, you know, jabbing that needle into his brother and, you know, you're welcome, and storming out. And I was just like, oh, man, you know, that he could stand up in the face of what his brother was hurling at him in, you know, and some of the things he said. I just thought it was
and
amazing.
And at the same time as not knowing whether what he's doing
was
is actually having any effect, he's possibly going to kill him.
And the moment when he realizes that, when he's talking on the phone to Cass and Cass goes, you know, he might have to, and he kind of leans back against the wall, you know, I'm gonna kill my brother. You know, like it's that moment that it really dawns on him what he might have to end up doing. That was brilliant.
Oh, amazing, amazing stuff. And I mean, the emotion in it is just, and cleverly, I think too, with the writing, and the way the episodes have fitted together, because in some ways we sort of like Demon Dean. You know, he was sexy and fun, and even though he's a demon, he had we'd connected with him in a positive way. So then to have this in our face, it puts us in, you know, it's a jolt to us because suddenly he wants to kill Sam with a hammer, which we're not so down with.
Not so much. Yeah.
So I think that's very clever, you know, the way the writers of these episodes have built that across it, because, you know, if Dean had of, although Dean's Demon Dean has obviously done horrible and evil things, we don't see that so much. And even Lester that he kills was a, you know, was sleazy and an asshole. And, yep, you know, we were not that sad on an emotional level for that. So very cleverly, you know, we're loving Dean almost more than usual at the moment. And then this... There's the this. Real darkness is revealed. So
and it's so uncomfortable, and it made me really uncomfortable, and I didn't like him anymore. You know, I could appreciate him in many ways, but I didn't like him anymore. I didn't want him around anymore.
Yes, I mean, and you just don't know how is this going to be fixed, particularly once he's on the, you know, when he's on the run in the bunker. It's like. And I think, you know, I'm thinking like, okay, so, you know, and you lock him in a room, what good that's going to do?
He's not going to do anything. He's got a hammer for a start, and, you know, he's super strong, and he's just going to work his way, you know, exactly. Why is he locking him in this room and pleading with him? Come on, Dean, just come back. We nearly sorted you out. Dean's like, whatever, I've got just enough demon in me not to care, so I'm just going to kill you.
Yeah.
God.
Ooh, yes.
Oh, yes. It was pretty horrific.
And then, you know, and alongside this, we then have, you know, Cass and Hannah continuing their journey. And as we've already talked about, Crowley intervening when the rogue angel Adina turns up and is trying to take down both Hannah and Cass. And, oh, God love Crowley. I can't – I want to hate him because he's evil, but he's just so – snarky and dreamy.
He's so dreamy. He really is dreamy. I know, you know, you just want to hate him, but you just can't. You can't. And you know that everything he's doing is working towards his favour somehow, and we just don't know how yet. And in that in itself is intriguing and super fun because, well, you're sort of on tenterhooks the whole time with Crowley. It's like you see him do something and you're like, oh, yeah, and then you're like, but really, was that really what he was doing or was there something else going on? So you can't help but, you know, question every single thing that Crowley does and you know, or you just can't take Crowley on face value.
No.
And that's super fun. That's just so fun, you know, and you can't help but love him because of it.
Yes, even though I hate myself for loving him.
I know, but we all love him. That's why he's still here so many seasons later. Oh, dear.
Yes, he is. And then, you know, as we say, he turns up at the bunker at exactly the right moment. There's that awesome, awesome shot when he grabs Dean and Dean's eyes flash black and Crowley's eyes flash
Cass's eyes.
White. Sorry, Cass's eyes flash a gorgeous blue white.
Yes.
And Sam's just really relieved he hasn't got a hammer in his skull.
Yes. Or hasn't had to slash his brother's throat.
Well, yes. And then as we, you know, when they finally get him back, and this leads on to, you know, how he still has the mark of Cain. We don't know. I love Sam's like, you know, fuck it. Like, can I just enjoy
one moment at a time?
Yeah, I just want to get Dean a burger and I want to get drunk. I know. Like, I have to solve everything today.
I know. Cass just, I just loved it when Cass came in and told Dean he looked like crap. And Dean's like, can you just, you know, lie, you know, maybe just lie once, kill you? Well, it wouldn't kill me, but it was just so old school Cass. I just was like, oh my God. That was really cool.
And, yeah, and it was interesting. Cass, you know, making the point that, you know, maybe he could take some time off and not much going on at the moment.
Well, Dean's not going to want to do that because if he does that, he might have to think. And Dean's not going to be wanting to think at all. And, I mean, just It was such an ambivalent ending. I mean, even when he was cured and there was, you know, he kind of looked up and said, you know, what's going on, fellas? And but there was a moment after that where you couldn't read his face. And I think in the end
there's
of the episode,
ambiguity in there a couple of times too.
Well, at the end, he's sort of looking around his room and you cannot read what Dean's thinking, you know, and, but, you know, part of you, I went away wondering, is he cool with not being a demon anymore? Is he going to miss his demoness? Is he sad that he's going to have to feel everything again? You know,
he's still a demon.
I don't think he's still a demon, but I...
I
do think the Mark of Cain is going to be a big bother as we get down the track. I think he's going to be living on the edge, just waiting to see what happens to him if he kill somebody, or, you know, he's not gonna, you know, he's gonna be terrified to live as Dean Winchester, I think, just in case that Mark, you know, what that Mark's gonna end up doing. And, you know, he's got that on him now, and we know that what that means, we know that what that did to him before, you know, and what's gonna stop that happening again. Okay, he's away from the blade, and we know, you know, with Cain being away from the blade, he was able to live a life, and, yes, you know, live an emotional life. So he's away from the blade, but who's got the blade, you know, and that's shit. That's the bad thing. We know that he's got the blade, and Crowley's got the blade. I'm quite sure he has every intention of using it in some way to manipulate Dean to his way. But yeah, there was enough in Dean's face. I don't think he's still a demon. I think that he's going to be, obviously, you know, he's got the Mark of Cain, and that's going to be trouble. And it's going to make him different to what we're hoping he would be. But there was enough in his face just to question, you know, how good he feels about what just happened.
And I look, you know, there's obviously so many things, you know, Dean's going to have to deal with what he did when he was a demon.
Of course. I loved his line, though, you know, how's my brother? Does he want a divorce? I just laughed out loud.
Kes like, no, and Dean's like, you know, Kes is like, you know, just because you tried to kill him with a hammer doesn't mean he's
your brother.
It's like,
you're going to get over that. I know.
It's true.
Yeah, and Dean's right. You know, how screwed up is it that actually makes sense in their world?
But, you know, Dean will have possibly guilt over what he did when he was a demon. He may miss being a demon.
Yeah.
He may be angry. You know, he's likely to be both guilty about what Sam did in order to get him back and angry at what Sam Jets did to get him back.
And then he's got whatever it is in that the Mark of Cain makes him want to do, or, you know, has to deal with that. I think he's going to be super scared to kill.
Many, many feels.
Many feels. It was a full of feels episode. And can I just note that I think it was pretty gross that Sam left that piece of pie in Dean's room for like 6 weeks or something like that.
And I think it...
That disturbed the hell out of me.
It speaks to the quality of pie from Gas and Sip.
I know, it looked really good. And those scenes were beautiful when both the boys were looking at the photos.
Oh!
Yeah.
Oh God, and
heartbreaking.
Snaps to Jay Grisker and the original soundtrack of
beautiful,
like, you know,
that.
you get the family theme comes on,
it's like wow. And the fact that one of those photos is actually Jensen and Jared.
Oh, I know.
It's a behind the scenes Jensen and Jared shot, which, you know, is just adorable. It kind of makes it all so confusing.
Confused feels, but it was lovely. I mean, all the photos were, and that was, you know, and just to see them, looking at them. Of course, who prints out photos anymore? But whatever.
Well, they were old, but they were all old photos.
Old, like 2005. We're not talking like 1970.
No, well, true. But didn't you still print out photos in 2005?
No.
Oh, really? I don't know.
How many photos do you print out these days?
I never print out any photos unless Chris at Creation prints them out for me.
Anyway, it's a it's something that's used still in films. It's like when people have newspaper clippings stuck up on the wall. I mean, who does that now?
Does anyone
who
buy newspapers?
Prints stuff out? Like, you'd just have a Pinterest board, wouldn't you?
And you could have like
the 21st century.
A big sort of a visual board. Yeah, that'd be good. Electronic pinball.
It's a technique we will see used in films for years to come. I actually remember in...
Because it's not quite the same as them looking through the back of a digital camera.
Or a phone.
Or a phone.
I think it was in Pacific Rim, I remember. There's a scene where one of the characters has, you know, photos stuck up. And I'm like, no, dude, no.
In Pacific Rim, what year is that?
Well, it's a few years from now. Like, yeah, not so much. But I think it is, some, as you say, there's a certain nostalgia. But it will come a time, probably, you know, a decade or two from now, where people making movies won't have that nostalgia. So
no, they probably won't.
It'll still maintain as a storytelling device, I think. And why are we talking about this? Sorry, I got off on a
tangent. No, but it was lovely to see that, and it kind of mirrored that scene in when Sam went into Dean's room when he was trying to cure him, and you know, looked at the porn and casually lying on the couch and flicked through the photos. It very much mirrored the scene in the first episode where he walked into Dean's room and looked around and, you know, picked up the note that Dean had left on the pillow. So, you know, it reinforced to me how many times has he gone into that room and just kind of, you know, taken in his brother's room with his brother not being there. But it was, and then it was lovely to see Dean also, you know, flipping through the photos and having a little moment as he looked at a photo of him and his brother.
It was adorbs, come on.
It was, no,
it was
feels,
feels city.
It was full of feels. And then, of feels. Course, we get the extra little tease at the end.
Which I really dug.
Where we have another awesome ginger.
Yeah.
The rangers of awesome continue in Supernatural of a woman sitting in a hotel room with two of the hotel staff on the ceiling bleeding.
I love what Jared tweeted that Genevieve asked, why would you put them above the ceiling, on the ceiling, what? Right above you if they're going to bleed on you? I thought that was just like beautiful logic.
It was.
I was like, she's right. Wouldn't you put them somewhere else? Why do you want blood dripping on you?
They won't. They're not bleeding very much.
No, just a couple of.
But yes, who she is and what her role. I don't really want to speculate. I'm happy to wait and see.
Really enjoyed that, and I know that you've been watching The Flash, and one of the things that I really like about The Flash is at the end of every episode, there's that tiny little character tease about one of the leads, one of the main characters, and every single week you get a little bit more of a nugget, so you know that, you know, he's up to no good, but you don't really know what it is, but there's just this little, and it's almost like a Marvel Easter egg, and that's what this felt like to me.
Yeah, it's a and now, and what we don't know is how it ties into the story we've just seen, whether it's someone going forward, you know, and I like that. It's just to watch this space.
Yeah, I liked it too. I thought it was really neat.
She will be around at some point.
And she might not be around for a few apps for all we know, but, you know, it's just
get little...
It was just imposing, especially as Cassa just said, it's all quiet in heaven and hell. Yeah. Take a bit of time. You know, get better.
Catch up with Game of Thrones.
That's right. He's got to do that. He's got some TV to catch up on.
Oh, he might have been. Demon Dean might have caught up with Game of Thrones.
Well, this is true. I'm sure he would have enjoyed that.
It'd be very Demon Dean-y.
Yeah, I think so.
So two amazing, amazing episodes. As you said,
absolutely.
An incredibly strong beginning to the season.
Massively strong.
I don't know where things are going because, you know, we've got Cass and what's happening in heaven and on earth with the angels. But with the boys, I really don't know where. Obviously, we know next week's a Monster of the Week episode. After that's the 200th episode, which is bound to be one out of the box. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens next.
Very interesting to see what happens. And, I mean, they're shooting, what's episode 10 at the moment?
Yes,
is
I think
episode
so.
9 or 10 the mid-season?
Oh,
I think
it's
9. Yeah, so episode 9 was the mid-season. So yeah, we don't know what
what's next.
What's next? And I think that's really cool because normally in a season you know, you've either had a bit of a big bad come in at the end of the last season that we're having to carry over, or a big bad at the beginning of the new season.
Yeah, like last season we had the arc with Ezekiel/Gadriel.
So you have kind of a concept of where by episode four, which is what we're about to go into.
By episode two, you know.
Exactly. You know where you're going. But with this season, the first three episodes being so tightly woven around the central stories of the four characters, and particularly the brothers and the aftermath of Dean's death and his consequent resurrection of a demon, that we absolutely have no idea where the season's going. And I think that's really fascinating. Yeah. And I think that's super exciting. I'm like, oh my God, I have no idea what's going to happen next. And I can't even ponder it.
Yeah, no, it could be.
And how cool is that?
Could be anything.
That's super
could
cool.
be anything.
Yay.
So much more to come. So we have an episode next week. Then the following week, the retrospective will be replayed, which is partly because there are election thingies in the US, but also to make sure the 200th falls smack in the middle of the ratings period of sweeps week. And that's going to be amazing.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. The synopsis dropped this week and made me giggle in glee.
Yes, it's certainly going to be a big one. We know they put a huge amount of effort into it. They've gone above and beyond. And from the little things we've heard, it's going to be one to remember.
Yep, I think so. I have a feeling.
So we'll definitely, we might be back to talk next week's episode. We'll obviously definitely be back after the 200th episode.
Definitely.
Thank you for listening to Women of Letters.
Thank you so much, and we'll keep enjoying the show, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to the Women of Letters podcast. If you'd like to contact us, our email is wolspn@gmail.com. You can follow Amy on Twitter @AmyInSydney and Jules @SuperWiki.